You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The most recent Pew Forum study on religion and public life found that 28% of Americans had left the faith tradition they grew up with for either another religion or no religion at all. In fact, the numbers of Americans unaffiliated with any particular faith is about doubled to 16%. And for Americans 18 to 30, that number is around 25%. Well, my guest today, best-selling author of The Care of the Soul and Dark Nights of the Soul, advocates a return to spirituality for those disaffected by formal religion, a deep private study at home. His new book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World, reflects his own journey. He was a former Catholic monk for many years. He's currently a psychotherapist and university professor. Thomas More finds inspiration from a wealth of traditions, ranging from ancient Greek religions to Sufism to Kabbalah, that all inform his continuing Catholicism. In the book, he advocates a home study of religious texts and other important texts that speak in a deep way to you personally, meditation, borrowing ideas and practices that work intuitively for you. The name of the book, again, is A Religion of One's Own. It's published by Gotham Books. Thomas More is my guest today. Thomas More, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
This new book, A Religion of One's Own, the subtitle says it all. It's a guide to creating a personal spirituality in a secular world. Let me ask you, how many people out there are sort of yearning for their own personal spirituality? I think you give the figure of about 20%, really, of people who are trying to find their own way in the world.
Well, actually, I think the number is probably much larger than that, because at least I think that, because I've been traveling to talk about this book in bookstores around the country, and the numbers of people showing up are amazing to me, surprising compared to other books I've done. And the intensity, the interest that they have, and how much they agree that they're looking for something that's an alternative to religion as they've known it.
Give us a sense of your own personal spirituality, because you came out of Catholicism and still are, I believe, a devout Catholic. But one of the things you've done in your own spiritual life, it's done a great deal of reading and meditating on other religious and spiritual texts.
Yes, I began that when I got a master's degree in theology in Canada. Then I went on to study my doctoral studies at Syracuse University, and there I really branched out. And I studied Greek religion, ancient Greek religion, and Taoism and Buddhist, Zen Buddhism in particular, and a little bit of Sufism. And so I put all that together, and they have affected me profoundly. But within myself, deep within myself, I consider this all a ripening of my Catholicism. I feel like, you know, that being raised a Catholic, that it's in my bones. It's never going away, and I don't want it to. But at the same time, my practice and my attitude toward it has changed quite a bit.
Well, give us a sense of how studying Sufism and maybe the Tai Ching or Zen has deepened your own sense of your sort of home religion, if you will.
Well, you know, when I say this in the book, that you can go to another religion. You don't have to become a member. And your adventures in that other religious tradition, I believe, don't have to threaten or contradict your own position in any way. What they do is enrich it, because we used to say when I was in graduate school, in religion, if you know only one religion, you don't know any. It's not that you should be a member of more than one, but that you need to know what's going on out there in the spiritual world, especially today. I think the situation is very different today. In, you know, years past, people became a member of a religion, and that was it. And in fact, there was a lot of antagonism between the religions. But we live in a very different world today. So I think we can go deep. I don't think it's just the cafeteria approach to sample this and that, but you can really go deep into another tradition and be affected by it, and that enriches your life, whether you are part of a church or community, or whether you're just a seeker. I think it gives you a base and gives you information, spiritual information, for going ahead.
You had some really interesting things to say about atheism too, which I found really interesting, because, you know, a majority of people in this world are affiliated with a religion of some sort, an organized religion. There's this other group of people who are not affiliated with religion, but would consider themselves spiritual to some degree, and some very learned, some more sort of humanist, if you will, or coming from their own inside. And then there's those who would consider themselves atheists. And you had some really interesting things about how, in many cases, atheism is as dogmatic religion as a religion.
Well, I think it is. You know, when you look at some of the writings today by prominent atheistic writers, they are as devoted to their atheism, and they worked it out so carefully for themselves, and they define themselves against people and other religions that it does look very much like a religion of, you know, a religion of its own kind. And what I say too in the book is that I think what the atheists are doing is I think they're arguing against making religion too definite, too defined, too rigid. And in that, I'd agree with them. But they attack a religion that is rather superficial. I've never seen them argue against the religions that I know that are very subtle and that are not so rigid as some are. So I go so far as to say that I think some mystics in some of the religions are probably saying something very similar to what the atheists are, that we should really have a very open attitude towards the things that we believe and that we're attached to. The whole point is to be able to live life with right on the edge of your existence, you know, where you're really not certain about so many things. There's so many mysteries in life. And so I think an atheist is probably at that place, too, is trying to say, let's be more open. And so I don't shut them out. I think that what they're doing is probably valuable.
Talk about that idea of embracing the mysteries of life, because that's an interesting concept in which oftentimes adherents of various religions will try to erase those mysteries of life to show that there is a definite path, a sure path, a known, as opposed to Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns.
Yes, that's right. Well, I like to quote the Tao Te Ching in China that they refer to the Tao. They say that the Tao that can be known or named is not the eternal Tao. So I take that to heart, that we have to be careful that we limit the very thing we're devoted to, even like the name God. If we use it too definitely, then it's not serving our religion at all. That should be a name that opens us up to the mysteries. I mean, I learned that when I was a young kid in Catholicism, that, you know, that you don't know these things, but we do our best to approach them, to get close to them, but we don't know for certainty, and that's why it's a matter of faith and trust. So I don't think that what I'm saying here in this book is too radical from the point of view of you know, theology of the religions, but it is probably radical in relation to the way people ordinarily have thought about religion in the past.
Or relate to their own particular religion, which sometimes in some religious practices subordinates themselves to the leaders of that religion or the views of the leadership of the religion.
Well, that's one of the main points of my book here, is that I think it's time for us to take more responsibility for our spiritual lives. And in that sense, that's why I want to use the word religion here. No longer just submit ourselves to someone else's idea without thinking it through and without adapting it to our own situation and to our own ways of thinking. You know, there are an awful lot of people today who are leaving the churches. The churches are graying and emptying out. And you talk to young people and they say, well, what's religion about? Why bother with it? Not everybody, but a lot of younger people are feeling that way. And I want to address that. I want to say that you don't have to submit anymore to a system. You don't have to give up your own independent thought and your intelligence about things. I think that's why people are shifting today, because with technology and science being so strong in life today, people are, in a certain way, are quite well educated, you know, outside of school. And they just don't see a place for religion anymore. I would like to reimagine religion, redefine it so that it would be available for people, because if we go the route of secularism, we're in trouble in this society. I think we're going to see more violence and more problems.
You think that is one of the big reasons young people are turning away, that idea of subordinating themselves to the views of the leadership of a of a faith community?
No, I don't think that's the main reason. I think that is a reason that older people, I think, are probably leaving it. When I talk to large groups of people, as I have been lately, the older ones are angry. You know, a lot of people are angry for having given up too much to the religious structures. And they're angry about the way they've been treated in the past. They're really angry. And I bring that up to them, and boy, they really express it. The younger people, I think, just are indifferent. You know, science explains the world to them. They see, you know, they're busy at life, and they just don't see the point, I think, of religion.
Are they searching for their own spirituality, or are they just secularizing?
Well, I think they're secularizing. I don't think, it's hard to generalize there because there are people doing all kinds of things.
Sure.
But I do think that a great number of people are secularizing. When I write for a publication and I get feedback, you know, online, I've had a lot of people writing back saying, I'm fine without religion, thank you. You know, I don't need it. And that's one attitude. And I think that's a big one that we have to deal with. And I think the reason for that is that we have presented religion as this kind of narrow, rigid system rather than a method for living more deeply and living in a much bigger world.
And it's sort of an unending search for knowledge and a better way of living day to day and understanding the world, really. In the universe.
Well, yes. You know, without some kind of guidance that way, I mean, some things you have to learn. You don't just automatically have inside of you. And I think we have to learn that many aspects of the world, if not all aspects of the world, are sacred. For example, I think people have to learn that nature is not just a commodity, but it has its own spirituality, the natural world. We have to discover that we can be more contemplative, that we have to have our own sense of ethics, not just do what we're told, but follow our own intuitions and our own experience about what's the right thing to do and how to live.
Well, you know, as you read through this book and you see your own sources of inspiration from the transcendentalists to the Sufis to Taoism to Zen Buddhism and, you know, just virtually every faith tradition that offers you some sort of insight, I can hear the skeptics out there saying, you know, and you actually address this pretty early in the book, that this is universalism. This is, you know, what's the point of believing in everything rather than one thing? Or what do you say to those who, you know, say that those skeptics? I think you liken it, you alluded to it earlier, a cafeteria line or a salad bar.
Yes, that's right. Well, people do say that. I don't think it has to be that way. Yes, I agree that it's possible to go around and sample a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it doesn't amount to much. I understand that. But I've spent years, I've spent my whole life studying religion, you know, my whole life, my entire life. And I've been exposed to a lot of different spiritual traditions, and they have enriched my life and my spiritual life tremendously. I can't imagine having a spiritual life today without my experiences of Zen Buddhism, enriching my Catholicism. And it's not superficial. I think what happens is that each spiritual tradition has something special to offer. Like Zen is important to me because it keeps my thoughts about the nature of things and about religion clean. I mean, it lets you know that you can't be too attached to any language or any particular teacher or leader. If you become too attached, then you lose that quest, that search, that's part of it. I learned from the Greeks, Greek religion, that every aspect of life is sacred. That's really important to me, and it's a big part of this book of mine, that we have to discover that the world itself is sacred. And until we do that, we're going to abuse the world, and we're going to feel shallow ourselves.
My guest today is Thomas Moore. He's an author, psychotherapist, a former monk, author of the bestsellers Care of the Soul, Soulmates, and Dark Nights of the Soul, among others. His latest book is titled A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the first step is, you know, reading and understanding as you find your own way and find sort of a combination of maybe your existing spiritual practices and learning about others. And you've kind of alluded to some of the things you read, from Homer's Odyssey to the Quran, a special translation of the Psalms, of course, the Bible, Jane Hirschfield's Women in Praise of the Sacred, Jung's autobiography. You have a pretty wide reading list. You also spend a bit of time on Emerson and the Transcendentalist. How do they inform your own spirituality?
Well, let me focus for a minute on the Transcendentalists, Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau was a very big influence on this book. At first, I thought, in fact, of just writing about him, but then I made it broader. The Transcendentalists of New England, which is where I live and particularly interested in them, they were living about 150 years ago, and they were in a situation much like many people are today. They were rather frustrated that the religious institutions were not giving them what they needed. And so they began to imagine a religious practice that was outside the institutions. Henry David Thoreau, for example, said that things like getting up in the morning and having time to reflect was a spiritual act for him. And that's like the monks. I was a monk for many years. We got up in the morning and meditated right away. I recognize that when Thoreau says that. You know, he understands that something could be sacred even though it's not part of a particular religious tradition. And then he went and built a cabin by a pond and lived there for 2 years so that he could reflect and meditate. That was very much like many spiritual people who have left home or left their cities and gone out, some into the desert. He just went to the local pond, but he built a building, and that's something that many people do build churches and build meditation places. And it became the place where for him to establish his own religion. So the Transcendentalists, to me, are a very special model for what I'm talking about. And so if someone wanted to get some ideas of what to do, I would recommend that they read either Walden, Henry David Thoreau's Walden, which is a wonderful thing to read, or his journals. And his journals describe even more his attitude, how he did see his ordinary life as being spiritual and religious.
You also mentioned Emerson's Divinity School address.
Yeah.
What was remarkable about this?
Well, you know, Emerson went to Harvard, got his degree in divinity, and then practiced as a minister for a while and got into some trouble and decided to leave the whole thing. But then he created his own religion, really. He went out and gave talks all around New England and other places. And then he was invited to give this talk called the Divinity School Address, 1835, at Harvard. And there he laid out his idea, why institutional religion had lost its heart and soul, and where it had to go, where we had to go in the future. And Harvard was rather upset with his ideas, and he wasn't invited back for 30 years. But I think his statement was a very important one. It certainly relates to my book, A Religion of One's Own. And I think if you want to look at something that was written like more than 100 years ago, that was in the same spirit, you just read that Divinity School address of Emerson, and you get a lot of fresh ideas.
This is the first step, is reading, and you refer to it as almost a meditative reading of reading slowly, maybe even aloud, to understand the concepts, the words, to really almost savor the sentences as you read in a sort of a meditative way.
That's
The next step is to embrace mysticism. And I think as you write in the book, a lot of people, they have a pejorative view of mysticism or being a mystic. And so what does being a mystic mean to you?
Well, you know, it's funny that I can hardly believe that people are members of religion and don't value mysticism, because as I study and look at all the religions of the world, all of them, they all have their mystics. These are people who are especially intense in their spiritual practice within their tradition. There are many mystics in the Christian tradition, many, many mystics, men and women, who have had a big impact on Christianity. There are mystics in every other tradition. What they do is they meditate to the point where they lose themselves, they get lost, they get swept away, and they cultivate that process, that practice of becoming less the individual person, less aware of their ego and their sense of themselves, and they begin to participate, to use that word sometimes, participate in life itself in a bigger way. And they, some of them say that they feel that they approach then the divine or approach God in a way that is without the words and without even feeling that they are present. They get absorbed. Now, that's very intense. I'm not asking everybody to have that kind of a very strong extreme mysticism, but I think we can each have our moments when we get taken away by nature. I get it by, with art or music. I play the piano and I'm gone. You know, I'm gone for a while. So I advocate in this book a kind of ordinary mysticism, not the big, huge kind of mysticism you find in these great writings on the mystics, but an everyday experience where you use art or you go into nature and you just lose time, lose the sense of time. Those moments are very important as part of the spiritual life. And so that's why I put a whole chapter in here saying that everybody not only can be, but I think should be a mystic.
And you use the example of George O'Keefe, for example.
Yes.
You know, think of her imagery. It was of flowers, skulls, landscape, and sky. And of course, those great cross paintings, too, in which they're so much more than a cross. And that's a way of doing it, losing yourself in a landscape and creating your own, you know.
Yes, that's wonderful, yes. I'm glad you brought that up. I thought of her because I happened to be in New Mexico, and I was at her museum there in Santa Fe and looking at her paintings and thinking. And I read a biography and a few books about her, and I thought, you know, she had her own religion. She had to take a long time to find herself. She moved from New York City to upstate New York, and I forget, a couple of other places. And finally, she ended up in New Mexico, where she really found herself. And that's where she painted these paintings that define her. And you see that when she writes about them, when you read her letters, and you get a sense of what she was doing, she did have a mystical sense. She specifically says that she was not religious in the typical sense, but that, you know, there was something else going on with her that was religious. And I think that her paintings then have a sacredness to them because she allowed life to happen to her, and that's what a religious person does. A religious person doesn't have to be in control of everything. And that's what she did. And so even though she's not a member of a particular religion, I use her as an example of someone who is a very religious person who has contributed to the spirituality of America.
My guest today is Thomas Moore, author, psychotherapist, and former monk. His new book is titled A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. There's another section of the book that sort of looks at how you can make your own home a spiritual place, one from trying to understand. It's very interesting for a psychotherapist to say do therapy at home, but but understand, spending time to understanding your own actions, motivations, and how you react to the world. And also, you also tell this wonderful story of sort of having your own rituals at home, even with a small group of family or friends. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, sure. There are a couple of things going on there. One is the therapy. I think that as a therapist, it's my conviction that if a person wants to really be a very spiritual person, that one thing you have to do is deal with some of your psychological issues because they can get in the way. People sometimes get very involved in a church or a spiritual system. And what's going on there, it seems, when you talk to them, is that there are emotional issues being lived out in their spiritual practice. And if they are not aware of those things, then they really don't know what they're doing. They can get into trouble. So I think it's really helpful to know your own psychology. And I think, I'm just suggesting that you can do some therapy at home. You can tell your story, the story of your life. You can write out some of the episodes of your life and look at them from an emotional point of view and see if those same patterns exist today. And you can talk to friends and family members about some of these things. You know, not everybody, but if there's somebody you can be open with, that is a great thing, and that can be a form of therapy. Now, about your home, yes, I think that you can look at your home as a source of your spiritual, like, planting your spiritual life there. And I learned this as a monk, that it's very important to have a home, not in a literal sense maybe, but a home for your spirituality. As a monk, you know, I had a community of people to live with, and we had a schedule that we followed every day, and we had a place designed to foster contemplation. I mean, we had a lot of fun, and it could be raucous, but we also had this quiet as part of our experience. Now, in our home has a certain monastic quality to it. We do like to be able to be quiet at times, and other times we like to be, you know, have fun, but we also like the quiet, especially in the morning, quiet mornings, and we try to have colors and things in the house that promote that kind of calm. And what you're referring to there is that for a couple of years, I invited our neighbors over to our house, and friends, and I'd say about maybe 20, 25 people would come to our house on a Sunday morning, and we would do a ritual. I have, you know, studied these things forever, it seems, so it was pretty easy for me to put together some texts from various sources, and we had a little bit of, you know, using water and bread and wine and music and other things. And we had our own ritual, and today I bump into people, that was a number of years ago, today I bump into people who tell me that they participated in those little rituals we had, and how they still miss them and how important they were to them. Very simple thing, a very simple home ritual can be of great importance to people and help a neighborhood as well.
And of course, that's sort of the power of an organized religion, even if it's only semi-organized.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So what I'm doing there is sort of a compromise between the, you know, the organized religion and having a ritual for people to gather together. You know, there are lots of ways of doing this religion of one's own. There's so many ways of doing it. You have to use your own imagination. And yes, I know you're referring to reading. I think it is important to do some reading and some study about this. You can't just make it up off the top of your head. You have to become more informed. We have to be informed about a lot of things these days, and I think we could be informed about religion as well.
Well, it's a very interesting book, and there's so much more that we didn't even touch. The name of the book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. Thomas Moore, thanks so much for joining us.
Rich, I appreciate it very much.
Psychotherapist, writer, and former Catholic monk, Thomas Moore, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. It's published by Gotham Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa, and you can search through and listen to old episodes on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.